This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
Hello, Outriders, and here's hoping you've all had a cracking start to 2012. This week, we're going to find out a little bit about what happened at the Chaos Computer Club's Congress in Berlin, how one woman is developing fascinating virtual worlds for play, and what it is to be a geek of the sea, without necessarily being a pirate. So, to Germany first, in the annual gathering for the international hackers and technicians known as Chaos Computer Club. For 28 years, this event has brought together many of the world's finest technology minds to share and discuss cutting-edge techniques, products, and process, as well as cross-pollinating ideas. Frank Rieger is one of the official spokespersons for the event, and he described it in more detail.
The Chaos Computer Club is probably the world's largest hacker organization, and we double as both hacker organization and digital citizen rights organization. The CCC has always been half technically, half political, and we are caring very much for everything that has to do with their interaction of technology and society.
How has this event grown? Because it seemed that it used to be maybe a little bit niche for programmers and hackers, but now a lot of different people seem to attend.
Yeah, the event is basically growing from a few hundred people 15 years ago to now filling up here the whole building with over 3,000 participants. And we could have sold probably twice as many tickets if the building would fit them. The growth has mostly happened because the topics that we're covering, the role of technology in a society, is becoming so much more important, and because our everyday lives are becoming much more digital. And so the topics that we are interested in and that we have expertise in and that we're covering here are becoming much more important to everyone. And so this is why attendance is growing so much.
If one was to turn up at the event, what sort of thing would they expect to experience?
We're having a three-track conference program where we have quite a selection of interesting speakers, and also a separate workshop track where people can show and actually do show their projects and what they do and interesting stuff, or where, for instance, open source projects meet, usually only see virtually over the air, but meet in person here. Besides that, there's, of course, as every conference, the social aspect very important. So we're having very long breaks so people can socialize and see each other. Many people are coming here that see each other only once a year because they're coming from different corners of the world. So it's also a very international event. So we're having approximately half of the conference program is in English, the other half is in German. And for the important talks, we also have live translations running. So it's in very colorful things. So we're having talks ranging from hardcore technical stuff like reverse engineering of mobile phones to political and cultural talks that you wouldn't really expect on a hacker conference.
And so what's it like trying to organize something like this?
Yeah, it's a lot of work. So the Congress is completely run by volunteers. So as all things that we are doing in CCC is completely volunteer work. And so a lot of stuff needs to be organized and made happen. On the other hand, we're having about 10% of the participants who volunteer to work in organizing and making it happen and who do shifts in doing all kinds of stuff. And so this is how this event basically works. It's a large group of volunteers who share a common goal and want to make it happen.
What was your highlight of this year?
The highlight of this year was not a single talk, but mostly a strain of discussion that came up here, directed by a number of talks that we had, which is about the role of hackers and people who know about technology and programming in making technology that may fall into the wrong hands. For instance, censorship technology being deployed in oppressive regimes, or Trojans that are being used by states to snoop on people. Somebody's programming then, and probably some of these people are part of the hacker community. And so this kind of basically very ethical discussion about what do we do with the power that technology and our knowledge of technology gives us, that I found very refreshing because it was missing a little bit over the last years. And so that come very much to the forefront now, driven by the events of the last year.
So if we want to find out more, where's the best place to try online to learn about this?
The event has an own website. It's linked at events.ccc.de. There's also an English version available. And from there, you can find all the links also to stuff like the video recordings of the streams from all the talks and information from participants at the Congress. So all kind of interesting information is linked from there.
There were so many bright sparks at the Congress that it had quite an online presence for Twitter updates, video streaming and much more. But what was it actually like to be there? Nick Farr, friend of Outriders, is an accountant, hacker and activist based out of New York. I asked him about his attendance.
I was invited to this conference because of some activist work I was doing 5 years ago, and I just absolutely fell in love with it. This is the highlight of my year. This is what I look forward to, coming here to Berlin and taking part in this wonderful event with hackers from all over the world. And you know I do a lot of hacker events all over the world. This one has, I think, the deepest global reach and just sort of the deepest sense of family for an event of its size anywhere in the world.
What have you seen this year? Because it always sounds like extraordinary things happen.
Extraordinary things always happen here at the Congress. I really don't even know where to begin. One of the great things I think I've seen is there's been a really huge increase in the number of female speakers and female participants and children and families and people coming with their spouses to the Congress this year. That's the thing that I noticed. We have many, many more female volunteers who are taking active roles in becoming organizers, being on stage, taking care of different things. I mean, that's something that's near and dear to my heart, is trying to achieve gender equity in what is often perceived and what often occasionally is a more male-dominated world, I suppose.
Mm-hmm. So I take it that it's less like walking into the geek equivalent of, you know, a men's sports locker room.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I think this is probably one of the most all-human-friendly spaces there is in the hacker community. I know it's unfortunate, but there tends to be a little bit of chauvinism and perhaps even a little bit of misogyny in some other hacker events, and that's absolutely not tolerated here. And it's just amazing the amount of really cool research and really cool hacks that female hackers are coming up with, and they come here because they feel super comfortable presenting those things because they know that it's going to be a safe space for them and everybody. I mean, this year we had queer hacker politics, we had panels on, you know, geeks and depression, on top of really, really great technical content. Karsten Knowles always brings his latest GSM research here. Dan Kaminsky brings his latest research here. Sergey Bratis and Travis Goodspeed's packet and packet attack was really, really awesome to see here at the Congress. So you have just this wonderful, eclectic mix of really awesome technical content and really beautiful cultural content all wrapped up in a wonderful package of warmth and family and love.
Did you bring anything to the event yourself, or were you there as an observer?
I'm sort of the entertainer slash MC of the event. When rooms get really crowded or when there's a short break in between talks, I help keep the crowd warmed up, help manage with crowd control. I also manage the signal angels. They are the volunteers that stay on IRC and monitor Twitter, because the Congress has gotten so large. There's a real focus to try to involve people who are all over the world and facilitate people coming together in hackerspaces or in living rooms. We've had people on every continent except Antarctica sign up for a prioritized stream because they ran a location that we called No Nerd Left Behind, where people are welcome to come and enjoy the Congress and gather with some people and try to have a feeling of the Congress, even though they can't be here with us in Berlin. And the Signal Angels are a part of that. They're on IRC in all of the talks, relaying questions from people who are watching the streams and even occasionally helping engage in conversations with people who might be as far away as Singapore or South Africa or Santiago in Chile. You know, we had requests from all over the world, which I think really, really is awesome and really shows what kind of true global reach the Congress always has.
All right, then, if you had to pick a favorite, I'm going to put you on the spot. What is your highlight of this year?
The highlight for me was a really, really special lightning talk given by Amanda Wozniak, Steve Wozniak's daughter, about open sourcing hardware design. And I said, look, these things that you're talking about here at dinner, you absolutely have to do a lightning talk about them. And she said, sure, I've done lightning talks before. And this was the first time we've done the Pecha Kucha format in the lightning talks here at the Congress. And I said, you're a pro at it. Come over here and just do it and make it happen. And she brought the most amazing performance, just beautiful. I mean, she had rewritten her deck a little bit and just was absolutely on, and was the only lightning talk that the crowd absolutely demanded that she finished. And that, for me, was the highlight of this Congress. You know, I was just so blown away by her presentation, and everybody in the room was just really, really super thrilled. And the fact that, you know, a female nerd is clearly, without a doubt, the most talented nerd in the room, possibly the Congress. Seeing that for me makes me feel really special.
So, Nick, if we want to see more of what you do when you're jetting around at hacker conferences or your thoughts on these events, where can we find you online?
I really wish I was better at posting all my content online, but you can pretty much find wherever I'm at and whatever I'm doing through my Twitter feed, which is N-I-C-K F4RR.
From Berlin over to the United States, or maybe even into more international waters. Visualize a gigantic cruise ship. Now, at Wi-Fi and entrepreneurs, coders and a community, and we're headed in the right direction. Please welcome onto deck Blue Seed, an organization that is pitching an offshore incubator with quick access to the west coast of America by planning to anchor a ship 12 miles off the coast of San Francisco, all in the name of enabling foreign talent to work with Silicon Valley companies with less of a hassle when it comes to visa. Dan Daskalescu is the CIO of Blue Seed Offshore Visa Free Startup Incubator. I asked him to explain.
We've been labeled the love boat for entrepreneurs, and our value proposition is that we allow these entrepreneurs to come to Silicon Valley without having to go through the U.S. visa hassles and restrictions. We also allow Silicon Valley to attract more talent, so we believe it's a win-win both for these foreign brilliant geeks and for Silicon Valley. The idea is that they can come on to the United States on a business visa, which doesn't allow them to work on the U.S. So we provide this amazing live-work-play environment on the vessel. These entrepreneurs can come and live and work on the vessel, and using their business visa, they can come to the shore for business meetings to speak with their angel investors or simply as tourists.
Surely, if people are starting to work offshore from Silicon Valley, are they not going to want to spend more time on land? And then obviously the question comes again about visas and working, or do they have to spend a certain amount of time on the vessel?
There is indeed a limit. The U.S. lets you spend up to 180 days on land using a business visa, which figures if you go to the mainland every weekend for 2 days and you spend a day during the week, you'd be well within the regulations. As for wanting to spend a lot of time on land, that's certainly possible, but we are doing our best to create an environment that's so compelling you'll want to be there most of the time. If you think of a perpetual hackathon or a non-stop tech conference, this is the kind of environment we want to create, very conducive to innovation and creativity, and exposing you to a lot of fresh ideas from around 1,000 other entrepreneurs around you.
And what about, say, practical issues like medical services or indeed if you are prone to seasickness?
The general answer for all the practical issues is that there is a great precedent established by cruise ships. Cruise ships are a multi-billion dollar industry, and they do very well in terms of feeding people, providing electricity, internet connectivity. We are going to provide also ferry service. And for medical emergencies, we'll have two helipads on the vessel. And also, international regulations allow medical cases to be treated on mainland without visa requirements.
Then to take a place on the vessel, how much would this cost? Because to run the ship itself, you'd need a lot of staff to make it habitable, I'm guessing. And then, of course, with things like the very exciting sounding helipads, it doesn't sound like a cheap ride.
Correct. On the other hand, the market for cruise ships is very good for us right now, because the cruise ships on Vogue have a capacity of around 4,000 people. Some of them are really large. They can host as many as 6,000 passengers, which makes smaller cruise ships with a capacity around what they're looking for, 1,000, 1,500 passengers, surprisingly inexpensive. Also, we can do very interesting things like buying a cruise ship with defective engines, which would have very little value for everybody else. But since we don't plan to move our ship, we can get it for cheap. As for maintenance and the cost on board, we plan to charge a flexible combination of rent and equity from startups. So startups that are cash-strapped can opt to give us more equity, let's say 5%, while startups that have more cash on hand can give us only 1% of equity. And from our calculations, we estimate that rents will range from $1,200 for a shared cabin with a shared bathroom in the hallway to $3,000 for a private cabin with a nice ocean view. So there will be something to accommodate every pocket. And interestingly enough, this will be competitive with San Francisco, where a studio rents for $1,750. And also you have to pay for a workspace. And the price ranges from $300 to $600 for a desk, while as on the ship, the workspace will be included in the price that you pay for rent.
And so with this formula, is it possible then to have a form of entrepreneurship off the coast of almost every continent, and then in which case people could be actually citizens of the sea, essentially?
Exactly. You've intuited our expansion strategy. We've already received requests from Japan, seeing that they have a similar immigration restriction problem, and we've been asked to launch a ship there. The idea is that we want to provide win-win solutions based on local problems near the coast. And right now, startup entrepreneurs are a problem we can solve near Silicon Valley. In the future, we might be able to solve different problems, let's say biotech or novel medical treatments. And we might be located, say, near Boston for biotech.
People who support the immigration laws in the United States may say that they're there for a very good reason, and they're probably not going to like this idea as much as we do, maybe. Can you see that this would force some kind of change in legislation in the end?
That's a very interesting question. Surprisingly, almost every single article in the press has been positive about us. And the reason is that there is already an existing initiative called the Startup Visa Act, which aims for almost what we aim, to grant visas for entrepreneurs to start companies in the U.S. Unfortunately, this act has seen no movement in the U.S. Congress, and it doesn't really solve the problem fully. There are still many restrictions, such as your funds must come from U.S. angels. What if you have funding from your home country? And what Blue Seed does is we won't require people to have funding from a specific place. We won't require them to create a specific number of jobs or other restrictions like that. We plan to make it really easy for entrepreneurs to start their businesses here. The reason why the Startup Visa Act hasn't seen movement in Congress is that in the U.S., immigration is a very hot-button issue. And whenever we mention something immigration-related, it gets lumped in with illegal immigration, especially the southern U.S. border. The difference that Blue Seed makes is that we'll target very, very specific demographics. We'll have high-tech, skilled entrepreneurs who create jobs. So this makes our particular initiative much more palatable, and we can actually see support from White House. If you look on the webpage of the White House Office for Science and Technology Policy, they released a statement saying that they support foreign entrepreneurs and the jobs that they create, and they want to find legal ways to allow them to do so. But unfortunately, they have to depend on Congress for that.
And I understand that you're also attracting funding from some great technology movers and shakers.
Correct. We have Peter Thiel on board, so to speak. He's leading our seed financing round.
Where did this begin then? Who initially came up with the idea of, do you know what, we're going to get a really big boat and this is how we're going to do it?
The older idea is called seasteading. Seasteading is, let's call it an initiative of furthering permanent ocean communities. They don't exist at the moment, but there has been a lot of research done by the Seasteading Institute on how these communities might exist, what businesses might thrive on them, what regulations will apply, what laws are applicable depending on where you are situated on the sea. If you are within 12 miles on the coast, the legislation is quite different from a place that's 200 miles away. You cannot fish, for instance, within 200 miles from the coastal state unless you have permit. You cannot drill for oil and so on. So all this research has been done at the Seasteading Institute. And at some point, the institute, being a non-profit, concluded that in order to actually launch the first floating colony, they had to spin off a for-profit branch. And my two co-founders, Max Marty and Dario Mutabja, who work for the institute, have started this venture. I was an evangelist, still am an evangelist for the Seasteading Institute, and I joined them in September to work on Blue Seed.
So if some of our outriding listeners quite fancy the idea of a life at sea, where can they find out more?
We encourage people to check out our webpage, blueseed.co, and we answer a lot of the commonly asked questions on our FAQ page.
Back on dry land and more innovation with a woman who can take you to places that don't quite exist. But you'll still get to physically interact there. Intrigued? Well, I was pretty wowed by Sahar Fakui's grit. Sahar is a postgrad in architecture, and she shared her visions in virtual activities.
My interest in architecture at the moment lie predominantly in virtual environments and how we can kind of augment physical spaces with virtual practices that we experience all the time online and through gaming networks. So, you know, I'm interested in bringing them out into the physical and augmenting them into an everyday practice.
And so for those of us who haven't come across your work, and this week I've certainly seen it around online a lot because it's outstanding, what exactly is the grid?
At the moment it's a very early prototype, but the idea was to create an immersive gaming environment. I'm using pretty kind of known technology. It's just augmented reality on the iPhone. In terms of the technology, it's nothing new, but the idea was to kind of scale it up at an architectural scale, cover a room with marking systems that you could walk around in a maze. The original idea was that it would be a maze that you could walk around in real time and experience through augmented reality. So that's kind of what the grid is at the moment.
For those of us maybe who aren't so familiar working with augmented reality, how does this look and feel then? I understand. If you're using a phone, what would
Yeah, I mean, at the moment we're using an iPhone to test. It is somewhat immersive because when you're walking through the room purely looking at your iPhone, you do get quite immersed in what you're experiencing on the screen. But I think at a much better scale in the future, the concept that I'm relying on is that we'll, you know, we will all be kind of be wearing these portable glasses, augmented reality glasses, which create a far more immersive environment than you walking around holding your iPhone in front of your face.
So essentially it overlays a virtual environment over what you would be able to see through the camera
phone. The idea is generally that you get the camera feed, and on top of what you see through the camera feed is a virtual environment like a model or a maze or some characters, and that's overlaid on top of the real-world data. So you kind of feel like you're surrounded by these digital models or whatever it is in the augmented reality environment.
There's video footage online of this working at a scale that you can sort of pass through the virtual space with your hands.
Exactly, yeah.
And what is it like then trying to scale this up to sort of full people size, as it were?
I did two tests in the grid. The first one was a kind of simple tabletop game where you have kind of a simple marking system and then you look through your iPhone at this digital model that you can walk around and you can kind of touch. Then I decided to scale it up at an architectural scale and cover a whole room with these marking systems that you could walk through, navigate through, and experience what it would be like to be in this immersive environment. I think for the future, and the feedback I'm getting online and from everyone that's seen the videos, I think everyone wants bigger and better, and everyone's saying that, you know, the bigger the actual environment is, the better the experience.
So no pressure there then?
No pressure at all. But yeah, because I was thinking at the end of the project, I mean, it's a prototype at this stage, but I was thinking, God, maybe this is too hard scaling it up and making everything so big. Maybe I need to just go back to tabletop augmented reality. That's where I'd left it off. But after all the feedback, everyone seems to be kind of like, no, you need to make this bigger, you know, huge scale.
And so are you surprised at the way that people interact with an environment that essentially isn't really there?
Yeah. Well, that was one of the biggest intrigues for me when I started this. I wanted to see what people look like when they're walking through this environment that actually doesn't exist, but it's just something that they're seeing through their phone. And in the film, The Grid, there are clips of, you know, what people look like when they're walking through this kind of physical environment, but actually they're immersed in something completely different. And for me, that's a really interesting part of the project, how we can navigate and kind of change people's general circulation routes through space.
What was it like approaching something to create it out of AR? I mean, is this your background in training to work with this kind of code?
I did a master's in computation, and for the past couple of years, I've been really intrigued with moving image and compositing and kind of special effects and stuff. But for me, what I find most intriguing is when everything happens in real time. So instead of kind of spending hours in post-production, I'm intrigued by how you can create animation and games and effects that happen in real time. And I think augmented reality just seemed like the natural progression from my interests. Of course, linked in with architecture, I think, personally, I think the future of architecture is far more virtual than physical, given the economic crisis and the kind of lack of buildings happening anyway. You can take digital modes of working and actually incorporate it into the physical environment. That's when I think it gets really interesting.
I think it sounds like a nice idea if I could turn my scruffy flat into something slightly more sumptuous.
Yeah,
that would work for me.
Well, there's thousands of ideas of what you could do in one-to-one scale.
So where's the best place to find you online and to indeed watch all of these fabulous videos?
I'm on Vimeo quite often. So if you search for Sahar Fikui, also you can catch my blog, which is www.saharfikui@blogspot.com.
Defining the meaning of digital outrider there, Sahar Fikui. I can't wait to see her full-scale game come to life at a grand scale. Well, all of which draws us to a close. I won't be with you next week, but as you can imagine, I am never far away from the internet connection, so I can catch up with your talking points, messages and ideas. If there's something you'd like to hear more about, you can write me an email at outriders@bbc.co.uk. Add us to your Facebook feed, just search for Outriders, or come and say hello on Twitter, where we are BBC_Outriders.